Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. How often have you thought or talked about the weather this week? It is really difficult not to, given we've all been surrounded by heat. The entire weekend just sweltered, but Sacramento hit 109 degrees on Sunday, and that broke an 88-year record set back in 1935. And we're not alone. Extreme heat is coating the United States, Europe, and Asia. And this follows the Earth just having its hottest June on record, according to NOAA. If it feels like we've been here before, it's because we have. Breaking records is becoming a norm with devastating consequences. Last summer's heat wave in Europe killed more than 60,000 people, according to the academic journal Nature. While forecasts typically focus on the immediate days ahead, we're going to take a long view. Claudia Tibaldi is a scientist at the Joint Global Change Research Institute and has been studying increasingly frequent and longer lasting heat waves for more than 20 years. Welcome.
Hi, Vicky. Thank you for having me and for the opportunity of talking to your audience.
Thank you for taking the time. It's an important conversation and a timely one at that. What led to you studying extremes and climate change?
Well, in 2003, somebody may remember, there was a big heat wave hitting Europe. Paris was at the epicenter of that heat wave. And at the time I was starting my career, and my mentor, who was interested in general about, you know, projections of climate change, we thought of focusing on heat waves in particular. And we chose the Paris heat wave sort of as an example, as a template to then go and interrogate our climate models for what this type of events would become in the future. And that led to a paper that was one of the first ones to tackle this issue. And that was in 2004. And yeah. I was actually thinking about the fact that at the time we used the word extreme as a synonym of rare. But unfortunately, this is no longer the case. Extremes are no longer rare.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when going back, you know, nearly 20 years ago, that paper in 2004, it was published in Science, and the title was More Intense, More Frequent, and Longer Lasting Heat Waves in the 21st Century. That actually led to you testifying before a Senate panel about climate change. Did you see this coming 20 years ago, us having this conversation now, as there's really regional heat waves happening across the world?
At the time, it appeared like, you know, a problem far in the future, and it has been kind of humbling and concerning to be faced with, as you were mentioning, this repeating of these problems year after year, season after season. So I guess the pace and the intensity that we observe in the last few years has caught many of us by surprise.
Given that this is your field of study and one that you have really been knee deep in for decades, you know, there are just so many headlines from around the world about the heat. I mean, obviously we feel it immediately. We're here in Sacramento, but then you brought it in. You're like, oh, the Southwest is going through a heat wave, and then Europe as well, and Asia. When you read these headlines or take this news in, you know, how I would imagine you have a deeper understanding of why this is happening.
Well, there is a very simple explanation, at least, of the general tendencies of what we are seeing. So just the fact that the world is warming on average makes these events more likely, and when they happen, more extreme, because what we see as a warming in general translates into warmer extremes as well. So that is, of course, the simpler explanation. But some of these events are so intense, so unprecedented, that require more than just that explanation. And there is where, you know, our science still needs to advance, still needs to investigate more deeply what's at what is taking place here. And the reason is that we are warming the planet. And as we know, the planet is a complicated system where everything is interconnected. So just the warming causes changes, for example, in the circulation that create, I'm sure people have heard of these high pressure domes where, you know, the air becomes stagnant day after day and creates these effects of, you know, overheated temperatures over a certain region without escape. So, but those effects are more complicated to both model and predict. So there is more work to be done.
So, I mean, learning that, I mean, it's obviously interconnected when we're talking about the climate and our atmosphere. So these heat waves, they're not just coincidental. They're all connected. They're taking place at the same time all over the world.
Yes, the IPCC that has written a report recently has you know, made it clear that it's not only an increase in frequency and intensity of this event, but it's an increase in the likelihood of them happening at the same time. And that, of course, creates problems also, for example, if we think of, you know, our food supply system, where heat waves that may happen at the same time in different bread baskets could cause, you know, shortage of food around the world. And of course, we see things happening not only in terms of heat, but as you well know, we are seeing at the same time extremes in precipitation all around the world, in the US, in South Korea, in India. So we are really amping up the system, and some of these behaviors are, you know, unprecedented and at a certain level unpredictable. Of course, we have also El Nino now that is a natural phenomenon, but we know can superimpose its effects to this, to these warming tendencies, and we're really in a new world, in the sense that every year is a new state of the system that we are experimenting with, which is fairly scary.
Are there parts of the world that concern you the most, or more than others?
Well, I should say that, you know, one of the fortunate things about working where I work is that we don't limit our studies to the physical climate system. We look at how the hazard that the physical climate system brings about impacts society, the economy, the natural world. And we know that the final effects of these events are not only just a function of what happens in the climate, but it's a function, they are a function of, you know, the preparedness of society, the resources that we can bring to face this phenomena. So to get to your question, of course, we are most concerned about, you know, the poor, which can be the poor countries of the world, but also the poor, you know, segments of our societies in our developed countries. Those are the people that, first of all, are more exposed. For example, you know, workers that work outdoors are more prevalent in developing world economies. And so there is more exposure to these extreme events in those countries, but also in our economies, the workers outdoor are usually those that have less means to face these problems. So there is more exposure, and of course there is more vulnerability because there are not the resources that our rich societies can put to facing these events.
Well, Claudia, thank you for the time and your continued work on this topic.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Claudia Tibaldi is a scientist at the Joint Global Change Research Institute. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about increasingly frequent and longer lasting heat waves across California, the country, and the world. So the heat can be brutally uncomfortable, but the reality is it can also be dangerous. Given the ongoing heat wave, CalOSHA, that's the state's agency which focuses on workplace safety, they announced that they are ramping up resources for those who have to work outside.
And our team is out in full force right now conducting targeted inspections to ensure employers are complying with the law, with a focus on construction, agriculture, tree trimming, landscaping, car wash, and warehouse industries.
And the state says it's also focusing on the most vulnerable residents with its Heat Ready campaign that is in multiple languages.
We are focusing on communities who are most at risk, including our older adults, our young children, those with chronic health conditions, persons with disabilities, those who are pregnant, and people in urban communities.
A tragically common and preventable consequence of hot temperatures are heat stroke deaths inside vehicles. They happen every year, often killing children and pets, and there have been 12 so far killing children this year alone across the country. That number comes from a database created by a meteorologist who is based at San Jose State University. Joining us now is Jan Nall, the founder of NoHeatStroke.org. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicki.
Well, before we dive in to this organization, NoHeatStroke.org, you were a meteorologist at the National Weather Service for 25 years. With that experience in forecasting, how have heat waves changed?
You know, we're seeing more of them, and everything going on in the atmosphere right now has some, you know, climate change DNA in it. It's hard to pick out exactly which one would have happened anyway, but we are seeing more of these events. And just like we had a stagnant weather pattern this past winter, which made us so wet, now we're into another stagnant weather pattern, shorter term, where we've had these areas of high pressure across the Southwest and in through the Southeast, and with extended periods of hot weather there.
Hmm. When did you get involved in studying and preventing, you know, heat stroke deaths in vehicles that primarily affect children?
So I first got involved back in 2001. I had a phone call from a member of the media in San Jose who there had been the death of a five-month-old child, Kyle Patrick Gilbert, who'd been left in a car. And he asked me, well, Jan, how hot could have gotten in that car? And I go, well, I don't know, but I'll Google that. Somebody's done a study. Well, nobody had really done anything very comprehensive. So I started keeping track of temperatures in my own car. I did a controlled study the next summer 2002, where I looked at days between 72 and 96 degrees and kept track of temperatures out through 1 hour in 10-minute increments. Ended up working with a couple ER doctors from Stanford, and we published that in that study in the American Academy of Pediatrics in 2005, and it has literally become the go-to study in the world on the topic.
Mm. So how hot can cars get, and how fast?
Very hot, very fast. In the first 10 minutes, a car heats up 19 degrees. So let's say it's a typical summer day in Sacramento of 90 degrees. In 10 minutes, that car is 109 degrees. For a small infant child, that can be a lethal temperature. After an hour, temperatures rise about 45 degrees above whatever your starting temperature was. So our 90-degree Sacramento day in the summer, we're now at 135 inside that car. That's hotter than the hottest day ever in Death Valley.
And given that these are preventable, but yet they continue to happen, do you have a better understanding of why they happen? Are people just leaving children in cars thinking that, you know, it's generally safe and unaware that it can get so hot so fast?
So these instances fall into three broad categories. The largest category, a little over 50% of the cases, are where children are accidentally forgotten in a car. A parent or caregiver gets distracted in some way. They can be overtired. They can be talking on their cell phone when they're getting out of the car, forget the child out. They think someone else is getting the child out of the car. Then the next category for about 25% of the cases are where children get into a vehicle on their own. Last week, a six-year-old in Florida died inside a hot car. He got inside a car, was overcome by the heat, and died from that. There's strategies, and we can talk about these in a moment, about sort of how to prevent some of these things. And then the third and probably the saddest category, where about 20% of the cases where a parent or caregiver thinks it's okay to leave the child in their car while they go run an errand. I mean, it may be an appointment. It may be going to going to a casino or going to a bar or meeting up with somebody. And, as we talked about how quickly cars heat up, that's never safe.
When it comes to the symptoms and how fast this can happen, I mean, you call it's pediatric vehicular heat stroke. That's the formal name of it. What symptoms should people look out for if, say, maybe they forgot that they left their child in a car, it's been a few minutes, they rush back to their vehicle, and they want to assess their child to make sure that they're okay?
So the clinical definition for heat stroke is when the body temperature gets to be about 104 degrees. And that's when the body starts going into this let's try and save ourselves mode. One of the things it does is it stops perspiring. So if you see a child who has a flushed face, but they're not sweating, they have a dry forehead, that's the first thing that first responder looks for and say, okay, this is heat stroke. We need to treat it much more seriously than, well, this child is sweaty and just overheating. When a child's body temperature gets to be 107 degrees, not that much more above, we've already gone up from normal up to 104, about 6 degrees. Now we're only going up another 3 degrees. At 107, cells inside the body stop functioning. And then organs shut down, and you have this cascade. And unfortunately, death can happen very, very rapidly. And especially small infants and children, where they are, often in a car seat. We all cool ourselves by perspiration. Well, if you're sitting in a car seat or in any type of seat, your back, your buttocks, and your thighs, they're not evaporating. That perspiration is sitting there and staying hot. We cool off by the perspiration on our arms and other parts of our bodies evaporating. We get that evaporating cooling to the body. So these things happen much faster in an infant or small child. Pediatricians estimate infant small child's body will heat up 3 to 5 times faster than yours or mine would. So you and I can be sitting in a hot car, 120 degrees for 10 minutes. We're going to be super uncomfortable. A small infant could die in that time.
So that brings me to my next question, because I was looking at the deaths that have been recorded on your website. The first heat stroke death in a vehicle that you recorded this year, I mean, it happened back in February. It was in Alabama. It killed a 2-year-old, but the temperature was only 79 degrees. How does that happen?
Well, that was probably one of the biggest takeaways from the study was it doesn't have to be a super hot day for these deaths to occur. Let's say that 79 degree day, you're going to be in excess of 120 degrees after an hour inside that car. And so, that is certainly a temperature that can cause a death. There was a case at the El Cerrito BART station here in the Bay Area a few years back, where it was a 67 degree day. A child was accidentally left in the car for a number of hours and died from pediatric vehicular heat stroke. So that's a really important message. A hotter day causes these conditions to come on faster, but if a child is in a car for an extended period of time, even on a mild day, it can be deadly.
Mm. Finally, we only have a minute left. What legally can you do if you see a child or even an animal inside a vehicle?
So there are lots of Good Samaritan laws. California, I know, has one for pets. I'm not sure if we have one for leaving children. But in having done this for almost 20 years, I have never seen an instance of a person who got a child out of a hot car be prosecuted. They get citizens' awards. And so if you see a child in a hot car in any sort of distress, call 911, and if necessary, get that child out of the car.
Jan, thank you so much. It's really important information.
I'm glad I could share it with you.
Jen Nall is an adjunct professor of meteorology at San Jose State University and the founder of NoHeatStroke.org. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.